thank you for joining us today on our podcast, Manage Your Money God's Way. We're from Compass Catholic Ministries. Our mission is to teach what the Bible tells us are the best practices for handling money. Yes, the Bible. That's our workbook. Over 2,500 verses in the Bible that deal specifically how we all should be handling money. And we teach these principles in our small group Bible study called Faith and Money Matters. You can learn more about the Bible study by going to compasscatholic.org. Click on Books and Studies. My name is Steve Holbrook, and with me, the co-founders of Compass Catholic Ministries, John and Evelyn Bean. In our Bible study, and also when we coach individuals and couples on their finances, we spend some time talking about the importance of having a will. So we thought today would be an excellent opportunity to have an expert on the show.
Yes, Steve, we do. We got Vanessa Skinner here, and she's the co-chair of Wills, Trusts, and Estates at Winterweedle, Haynes, Ward, and Woodman, which is a law firm here in Winter Park, Florida.
We're glad you're here, Vanessa.
Thank you.
So, Vanessa, one of the things that we talked about when we invited you on the show was estate planning. Now, we don't have a lot of money, so what does it mean for us to do estate planning? It just sounds like something rich people do.
Right, and that's a common misconception, but really, truly, we all need an estate plan, and that's going to include a will, possibly a trust if it's appropriate for your circumstances, and then other documents such as a power of attorney, a healthcare surrogate, a living will. Those are the sorts of things that all together make up an estate plan.
And why do I need a will? I mean, like she said, we don't have that much money.
What happens is if you die without a will, then the state will decide what happens to your assets at your death. So the will is an opportunity for you to, shall we say, control things from the grave and make sure that your wishes are honored. Here in Florida, if a person dies without a will and they are married, then their spouse is going to get 100% of everything. If they are in their second marriage, though, and they have children from a prior marriage, the children from their prior marriage are actually going to get 50% of everything, and their spouse is actually only going to get 50%. And so if you want to be able to dictate how your assets are distributed and you don't want the state making those decisions for you just by virtue of the statutes and what they say, then it's very important to have a will, regardless of whether you have significant wealth or more modest wealth.
One of the things I've heard from various people is if you don't have a will, the state's going to take, you know, half of what you've got.
There is a provision in the statute that says that the assets could, we say, escheat to the estate, but that is only if there are no other heirs who are surviving you. So if you die without a will, it's called intestate, and the intestacy statutes have provisions for spouse, descendants, such as your children or grandchildren, your parents, your siblings, so on and so forth. If all of those individuals have predeceased you, then the ultimate beneficiary would in fact be the estate, or the state of wherever you reside.
Wherever you are. So if you had a desire to leave a bunch of money to your church, or to your college, university type of thing, or to a specific charity that you have a heart for, but you haven't created a will, you haven't made any provisions to put the money for those kinds of things out there, register it, then it's not going to happen.
Correct. If you have any desire to make charitable distributions at your death without having a will in place, that's not going to happen unless you've set up in advance some kind of a donor-advised fund with a particular financial institution.
So do I need to see a lawyer to do my will, or can I just use an online version of the will?
That's a question I get asked quite frequently. And candidly, I'm going to say you need to see a lawyer, and that's not just because I'm a lawyer. I have seen cases. There's one particular case here in Florida that many years ago, well, not too long ago, but LegalZoom, of course, a lot of people use LegalZoom or these other types of online document production tools. And in this instance, a woman had identified each and every asset that she owned using the LegalZoom document, saying how she wanted each of those assets to be distributed at her death. But she didn't have what we call a residuary or a catch-all provision. And at the time of her death, she had inherited some additional assets from one of her family members. And because it wasn't specifically addressed in the will, those assets had to be treated and distributed as if she died without a will. And so it creates more costs, court costs, attorney's fees, and other complications, possible tax implications. And we've also seen instances where folks that use these online document programs, they're not properly witnessed or notarized, which may affect the validity of the documents. And so that can be really critical as well. So it's always important to consult a professional. It's much like when you're ill, there's some benefit to looking at WebMD, but ultimately you're going to want to see a medical professional to be properly diagnosed and treated.
So if I need a will, what do I look for in a lawyer? How do I find a lawyer that's going to meet my needs?
Most of my clients are referred to me either by their friends or family members or through their financial professionals that they work with. CPAs are great resources because they have the opportunity to work with estate planning attorneys on a regular basis. Financial advisors, again, they have an opportunity to really vet the professionals that they're working with in the industry. There are local bar organizations. Each state and each county has a bar association which lawyers are members of. And so those will oftentimes have lawyer referral service programs that are free of charge. And you can contact them and say, look, I'm looking for an attorney in this practice area like estate planning. Could you please help me find someone in my area who's, you know, well-established and well-respected?
In listening to what you said, the bottom line that I heard is that some of these prepackaged programs are good as far as they go, but they don't necessarily get all the I's dotted, the T's crossed. And like in the provisions, the catch-all provision that you mentioned, they may or may not have that. And so you're kind of left naked.
You get what you pay for. And candidly, part of being an attorney, one of the key roles that we serve is that of counselor. And estate planning is a very personal process. Folks are coming to you talking about family issues and different dynamics that may or may not be even comfortable for them to discuss. And so the counseling part of it is really important to determine what type of document is needed. How are we going to draft that document? So if they're just filling in forms online and it's generating a, you know, a document, they're not looking at all of the various considerations that go behind the drafting of the documents.
If I'm going to see a lawyer to get a will, what kind of decisions do I need to make beforehand, or what do I need to think about before I go?
What's really important is to start thinking about who do you trust within your circle of friends or family to make those decisions for you in terms of who's going to be your executor or personal representative at your death. They're going to be the ones working through the probate process, and we'll talk about what that is in a minute, but they're going to be the ones handling the distribution of your wealth after you're gone. If you want to do a trust, who's going to be the trustee? If you have minor children, who are going to be the guardians to take care of your kids? Are the same people also going to be the ones administering the funds? Sometimes people are great caregivers, but they're not great with finances. With regard to lifetime incapacity planning, who's going to be your power of attorney? Who's going to make and handle your financial affairs in the event you can't do that because you have Alzheimer's or dementia? Who's going to make your healthcare decisions if you're in a coma and can't make them for yourself? Really, all of those fiduciary type roles, those very important decision-making roles, that is, I think, of utmost importance. And then, of course, the decisions of how do I want to distribute my wealth after I'm gone? Do I want it to go outright, immediately at my death, in equal shares to my kids? is one child not very responsible financially? Do I need to kind of have them receive a little bit over a longer period of time, which would maybe lend itself to doing more of a trust? So those are the types of considerations. But one of the key misconceptions that I find when I'm meeting with folks on a daily basis is they think that if they have a will, then they will avoid probate. And that's not the case. It's actually the exact opposite. If you have a will and you have assets that have to go under the will to whomever you've directed, that has to be probated. A will, any assets that flow under the will are subject to probate. And what that process entails, and it's going to vary from state to state, but generally speaking, whoever you've appointed as your executor or your personal representative is going to be appointed by the court. They're going to have to report to the court all of the assets that you owned at your death that are having to be probated by filing an inventory. They're going to have to determine, did you owe any debts at your death? Are there credit card companies, medical providers, mortgage companies? If so, then they need to give, and they'll hire a lawyer to help them through this process, but those creditors will have to be given direct notice and an opportunity to make a claim against your estate. And then we also are responsible for publishing in the paper 2 weeks in a row any possible unknown creditors that are out there. They have an opportunity up to 3 months to make a claim as well. And so during that creditor claims period, the estate is in a waiting period. We can't distribute any of the assets. If there's a sale of any real estate, those funds have to be held in escrow until the court has confidence in knowing that there aren't significant creditor claims out there that need to be addressed. And then once the claims period runs, then we go through the process of trying to wrap up the estate proceeding. So that's why, generally speaking, on average, it lasts about 9 months to a year to complete. And that's if you've got a probate judge who doesn't have a heavy docket, because it can take weeks, if not months, sometimes to get orders entered by the court. And so sometimes clients will come in and they'll say, I absolutely want to make sure that a probate is avoided at my death. I don't want my kids to have to deal with this. I just want things to be distributed seamlessly without any delay.
And you do that through a trust?
Yes.
Yeah. So you're Catholic?
Yes.
We're a Catholic ministry. What part does faith play in creating a will, creating a trust, in any of the documentation that needs to be completed?
These are such significant decisions for folks to make. And so I recognize, and I often say this when I'm meeting with clients, I know why people avoid coming to see me. I know why they avoid having the discussion about estate planning, because a lot of times it forces them to come face to face with certain issues within their family that they really don't want to have to address, let alone discuss with a professional such as myself. So I think faith is the foundation to help them through that process, to really pray over how they want to go about addressing it, because it does need to be addressed, and it's not going to be an easy process all the time, but it's an important one. And then in terms of how their decisions, you know, faith is obviously going to be pivotal in determining their decisions regarding their health care and whether or not they want to have life prolonging procedures employed, whether they want tube feeding or IV fluids, and how long they want to be kept alive artificially on breathing machines. And, you know, certainly that's part of the discussion as well. And even when it comes down to the disposition of their remains, whether they want to be cremated or whether they want to be buried. And I know with Set Your House in Order, it's great, even down to the music that you want played at your memorial service. You can have that say. And I think when folks are in the final stages of their life, they oftentimes feel so powerless. And so I think looking at the planning process as an opportunity for them to be empowered.
So we were talking about wills, but you just went into healthcare and decisions about health. So that is a part of what you need to talk to a lawyer about, but it's not part of the will, is it? I mean, the will is disposition of assets.
Correct.
So what do you call this other stuff that you're doing to prepare for potential incapacity?
And those are all of the other lifetime incapacity documents that when I talk about estate planning, I'm talking about those as well.
When you say estate, it's from a legal perspective. It doesn't necessarily relate to wealth.
Correct. Candidly, it's setting your house in order. It's talking about the disposition of wealth, but it's also talking about what happens if I can't make my own healthcare decisions? What happens if I can no longer pay my own bills? All of those decisions, we call it estate, but it's wealth planning, it's healthcare planning. And that's where most often people think about, when I say estate planning, they think, oh, it's just what happens to my assets when I die? How do I transfer my wealth? But it also serves another purpose, a really important purpose, and that's it. That is simply what happens for when I'm alive and I can't handle my own affairs any longer.
One thing that you mentioned that I think throws some people for a loop, and you were talking about being connected to multiple life-saving or life-supporting machines and that kind of stuff. I know that some people think, well, because I'm Catholic, I've got to just prolong my life forever. As long as the doctors can do something, they've got to do it. But that's not really the case. Can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, there's some things that you have to do and some things that you don't have to do.
Correct. So there are actually approved by the various dioceses around the nation, acceptable healthcare surrogate and living will type documents, which do not suggest or require that a person has to be kept alive artificially indefinitely. What they do stress, however, is that you cannot withdraw nutrition or hydration. And a lot of times the traditional statutory documents for advanced directives for healthcare purposes will say that those presumptively include withdrawing nutrition and hydration. And so a person, if they're going to use the one that's common in their state and they're not going to use the Catholic version of that, they need to make sure to tell the attorney that they're working with that they want an exception to be made clear in the document that they do not want nutrition and hydration withheld.
So if you're going into the hospital and they want to give you a end-of-life kind of document, you probably better not sign that without making a stipulation, or just bring your own, assuming you've already been through Set Your House in Order and you've completed the documentation. You bring that with you. So it's very clear what your wishes are.
Exactly. That's the benefit of doing the pre-planning, because the documents that they present to you at the hospital are never as thorough or as detailed as ones that you would do through Set Your House in Order or through working with an attorney.
So we've been talking about pre-planning, and ideally people would pre-plan well in advance, when they're young, when their family is young, so that they can make sure if something happens unexpectedly, the family's prepared. But if I do, let's say, a will when I'm 30 years old, how often do I need to review it, and what do I need to consider when I'm updating it?
You mean it's not one and done?
Not one and done. No. Nope.
We always say that estate plans are living, breathing documents. So wills and trusts, all of those, just like life changes, the documents are going to change or need to be changed. It's very common. Folks will do a will, put it in a drawer, and forget about it for decades. We typically tell folks every 3 to 5 years, take a look at your documents and see, are there any changes in your family that maybe result in you needing to revisit the documents? And there may be changes in the law that need to be, you know, addressed in the documents themselves. But we always tell clients, do that review every 5 years max. Normally a law change will not invalidate the documents, but it will oftentimes result in us having to amend certain terms. And an example of that is the passage of the Secure Act that just occurred January 1 of this year. It was enacted, and that is a spending bill that has significant impact on retirement benefits. A couple of the key changes is that now a person can be 72 years old and start taking required minimum distributions at 72 instead of 70 and a half. So it's delayed that a little bit. And there's no longer an age limit to when you can contribute to traditional IRAs like you would in the past with Roth IRAs, where you can contribute to that at any time. But the trade-off with some of those benefits is that we've done away with what we call the stretch IRAs, which in the past would allow for those retirement benefits to grow and appreciate and get the benefit of tax deferral for decades. And so traditionally what we would see is a gentleman would pass away, his wife would inherit the IRA, she would then take those required minimum distributions based on her life expectancy, minimizing the income tax to her, and then when she later died, their three children would inherit the funds. They wouldn't have to take it all at a lump sum. They could set up inherited IRA accounts, and then they could stretch out those benefits for their lifetime. Now the law says that's no longer possible. For most individuals, they're going to have to take it out within 10 years of the account owner's death. And that can be done over a period of the 10 years to kind of do maybe, you know, 1/10 each year to minimize the tax consequences, or they can wait and have what we call the tax bomb at the end of the 10th year.
Tax bomb.
Take it all
really
out
bad.
At once. Exactly. And have a significant income tax hit. There are some exceptions to that 10-year rule. If you have an individual beneficiary who is chronically ill or disabled, and we're having, for instance, to name a special needs trust, then we could still do the stretch. Surviving spouses can still do the stretch. Individuals who are within 10 years of age as the deceased account holder, they can still do the stretch. But that's not very common because most of the time we see it going to kids. And children of the account owner who are under the age of majority. What does that mean, right? Does that mean 18 years? Does that mean 21 years? Well, we're not sure. The IRS is going to have to issue some regulations because some of the commentary that we're seeing is that it could mean as high as age 26 if they're pursuing a course of study. So that's just a very long-winded example that I gave you of how estate planning is constantly changing. It's constantly evolving. And so we can't just assume one and done.
I've got a will. My lawyer kept a copy of it, but I've got a copy of it. What should I do with it?
So when you say a copy that the lawyer has, a copy that you have, my first question is, who has the original? Because that's the key. When we're talking about probating a will, we have to have the original. And if we don't, then that means we're going to have a more complicated probate process. So the lawyers may either retain the original, or if you retain the original, then I'm going to urge you to store it in a secure place for safekeeping. You always want to let someone in the family or a friend or a trusted individual know where those documents can be located.
So Vanessa, you've said a lot about the reason we need a will, and I totally agree with that, but a lot of people are probably worried about the cost. What's the average cost for a standard will?
I can only speak to what my firm charges. I mean, market prices vary, but generally, if we've got an individual that needs a will and those other documents that we touched on, the fee for preparation of those documents is $800. And normally lawyers will charge a flat fee. And a lot of times, like myself, they will allow for complimentary consultations with clients. And so normally the folks will come in, and because it's hard to quote a fee when you don't know the specifics about their situation and what kind of documents are going to best serve their needs. And so you'll sit down and you'll have a meeting and discuss that. And then by the conclusion of that first meeting, you'll have more direction in terms of what the cost is going to entail.
And if somebody's been through Set Your House in Order and they've completed all the forms in the Bible study and stuff, is that beneficial to take that in to see the attorney?
Absolutely, because that's going to frame the discussion. that they have with the lawyer about all of those roles, who's going to serve in each of those roles, and what are my wishes with regard to the distribution of my wealth.
So we've covered a lot of ground.
Thank you very much. Yes, that was very informative.
Yeah, we really appreciate you coming out. We thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Several times in today's show, John and Evelyn referred to one of our Bible studies titled Set Your House in Order. And having a will is a part of this 5-week Bible study. Everything you need to prepare for prior to going to see an attorney, questions you should ask, documents you should bring with you, go to compasscatholic.org, click on Books and Studies, and take a look at Set Your House in Order. Everything you need to do. So whoever's handling your affairs when you pass, they won't be stressed out looking all over your home for those important documents. And before we leave you today, we do have time to answer one of the emails that we received, and I was saving this one specifically for this show. All right, John and Evelyn, I'm 53 years old, and I've decided to stop procrastinating and do a will. How do I go about it?
The best thing to do is to get your financial statement together, along with making some key decisions, such as who you're going to leave your estate to, and then meet with an estate attorney who will draft your will. But always, always ask in advance what the cost of preparing the will is going to be. And Steve, by the way, let me put in a plug for our Set Your House in Order study and workbook. It's a great, great tool to help someone get their estate in order.
John and Evelyn and Vanessa, thank you for a great show today. We have a blog prepared that will highlight a lot of what Vanessa covered today on the show. If you go to compasscatholic.org and click on podcast summary, you will see all that information. Now, if you have any comments or feedback on today's show, or maybe there's a topic that you would like to hear us discuss, email your suggestions to info@compasscatholic.org. And for John and Evelyn Bean, thank you so much for joining us today. Remember, we have a brand new podcast for you each and every Wednesday morning. Simply go to compasscatholic.org, scroll down on the homepage, and click on that magical button that says podcast. This is Manage Your Money God's Way. We're from Compass Catholic Ministries.